These aren't people. These are animals. And we're taking them out of the country at a level and at a rate that's never happened before. And because of the weak laws, they come in fast. We get them, we release them, we get them again, we bring them out. It's crazy.
That was the President of the United States speaking to local officials and law enforcement in California on Wednesday. On Thursday, President Trump said he was specifically referring to members of the MS-13 gang.
We have laws that are laughed at on immigration. So when the MS-13 comes in, when the other gang members come into our country, I refer to them as animals. And guess what? I always will.
I always will. This is The Takeaway. I'm Tanzina Vega. And today, a look at what happens when we take our fellow human beings and make them something else. Something subhuman. Wednesday's meeting wasn't the first time the president used this type of language.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you.
I was reading one of these animals was caught.
I won't call them monsters because they would like that term. They would think that's a great name.
They're bringing drugs. They're bringing crime. They're rapists.
I know it doesn't sound nice, but not everything is nice.
So to use an animalistic language to characterize them is really placing them in an alien biological category. And it's an attempt to represent them as not meriting the sorts of attitudes that we have to other human beings.
David Livingstone Smith is a professor of philosophy at the University of New England and author of Less Than Human: Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. And he says that what President Trump is doing with this rhetoric has been happening for centuries in this country and for millennia around the world. And guess what? There are consequences.
When you refer to a subportion of a racialized group using this sort of language, what listeners tend to do, who are responsive to that sort of derogatory rhetoric, is to generalize. So even if he specifically had in mind and for some reason didn't make clear that he was referring to violent members of a particular gang, the fact is that many of his listeners will almost automatically extend this to, in general, to undocumented Latino immigrants and probably actually even documented Latino immigrants.
Let's dive a little deeper into the psychology behind this. This is essentially, we're talking about dehumanization, and this idea when you dehumanize is really embedded in a hierarchy, a sort of racial hierarchy, right?
Yes, a racial hierarchy and a biological hierarchy. So human beings tend to think of the world as arranged in a hierarchy. It's a very, very old idea going back. Well, officially, it's supposed to go back to late antiquity, but I think it's actually much more ancient and much more widespread. The idea that there are degrees of intrinsic value. We human beings modestly place ourselves very high on this hierarchy. And what that means is that it's impermissible for us to treat human beings in ways that we feel free to treat other sorts of creatures. This is a kind of a ranking. Now, within the category of the human, and this probably, well, this is an old idea as well, but it really picked up steam in the age of colonialism and the peak of the transatlantic slave trade, which would be the 18th century. The idea that within the human category, there are subranks as well. As this scheme was set up formally by white European men, they again modestly placed themselves at the top of the human hierarchy, you know, the paragon of humanity.
Quite a convenient placement, if you will.
Yeah, yes, indeed. Mm-hmm. And all these other racialized groups were placed at lower ranks. At the very bottom were, depending upon who was writing, sub-Saharan Africans or Native Americans.
And there's also the idea that they're, I mean, essentially saying that these people are not even human.
Yeah, so that takes it a little bit further. So when people get racialized, they're regarded as a different kind of human being, a different and inferior kind of human being. I don't think race is ever a neutral descriptive notion. Racialization arises out of conflict, exploitation, and oppression of human groups. So built into this sort of racial language are implicit ideas of superiority and inferiority. When you dehumanize people, you just push them one step further out of the category of the human entirely and into the twilight zone of subhumanity.
I want to also talk about some historical examples. We briefly touched on the transatlantic slave trade, but let's talk a little bit about how language was used to dehumanize different folks throughout the course of history. We have the slave trade, we have the Rwandan genocide, Cambodia. I'd love for you to help take us through some of these.
The use of dehumanizing language is very old. Some people see it as a product of modernity. It's not. We can find references to it in the writings of ancient China, Egypt, and Mesopotamia. Go back to ancient Greece. A very influential thesis was Aristotle's thesis of natural slavery. I mean, Aristotle basically argued that anyone who is not an aristocratic Greek male was defective. They were what he called natural slaves. And natural slaves were not fully rational. They weren't quite like cattle because they were capable of sort of what he referred to as a sort of passive rationality. But he thought they benefited from being enslaved so they could vicariously benefit from the superior civility of their masters. And this was an idea that was invoked again and again by the Spanish colonists in the Caribbean and what is now Latin America, by European slave masters in North America, and so on. The idea that these people are defective, not quite like livestock, but not quite like human beings either. After the Civil War and the collapse of efforts to secure the rights of African Americans in the South, in the United States, black men in particular were dehumanized and demonized. If you look at the rhetoric around lynching, you find consistently black men referred to as beasts, bloodthirsty animals, crazed. There is one example where the victim was said to be torn apart in a frenzy of gorilla-like fury. This sort of language was very, very common. If we look at wartime propaganda, we find the same thing. Enemies are described as subhuman creatures. During World War II, we certainly did that to the Japanese and used overtly exterminationist language, comparing them with lice that need to be exterminated. And the Japanese did the same to us, by the way. If you look at each of these wars, you much more often than not find this sort of language. But of course, genocide is the real hotbed of dehumanizing rhetoric. And if we go through all of the genocides of the 20th century, we find this kind of language. The group of people to be exterminated are described either as traditionally unclean creatures, lice, parasites, leeches, things of this nature, disease organisms, or as dangerous bloodthirsty predators.
And we're seeing right now there is obviously a lot of political support, at least from the administration, is really pushing this notion of who's allowed in, who's allowed out. How dangerous is this? How dangerous are these comments, these consistent comments from not only the administration, but also from average everyday people? We're seeing so many videos online right now with people just yelling at people for being who they are. Do you fear that it's going to go beyond viral videos and into more serious consequences?
Well, I'm sure it already has. I'm sure that there are hate crimes that are, let's say, empowered by this sort of stuff. But I don't think this is anything novel. What's happened in the current regime is that attitudes that were previously regarded as socially unacceptable to express publicly have now been given permission to. This was part of Trump's appeal, that he sort of gave permission for people to be authentic. In this case, the authenticity is a sort of authenticity that one would hope did not exist, but it nonetheless does exist. And it will exist until white America really is prepared to come to grips with its national crimes, its historic national crimes. And I'm afraid we're nowhere near that point.
David Livingstone Smith is a professor of philosophy at the University of New England and the author of Less Than Human, Why We Demean, Enslave, and Exterminate Others. David, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you for this wonderful conversation.
Now, some of you feel differently from Professor Smith.
Oh my gosh, I love it that you guys are defending MS-13. Those poor defenseless gang members. Wow.
And we got this message from Brenda on Facebook. The gentlemen in MS-13 who gang-raped my friend's 13-year-old daughter are animals. Either way, words clearly matter. What goes too far? How has language been used against your community or to stereotype your group?
Hi, this is Savita calling from Greenville, South Carolina. I'm part of an immigrant community that conventionally has been referred to in a positive light. Those of us from India and other Asian Americans were described by President Ronald Reagan as quote-unquote model minorities. This is still offensive and unacceptable, but not as abhorrent as what the current president has said.
Aloha aina. This is Pete Shimazaki, doctor, a second-generation Okinawan, calling from Moanalua in Honolulu in Hawaii. We Okinawans have been referred by Japanese government agents as savages still, while U.S. military continues to occupy and dominate our tiny islands for over 7 decades now. Policies or even being invisible in terms of respect and power can often be harsher than words.
This is Nikki from Arlington, Texas. Yes, as a Muslim, I get to hear how I'm a good Muslim compared to the majority of my 1 billion brothers and sisters who must be quote-unquote terrorists or radicalized simply because of something so random as in which country they were born.
This is M.J.J. Cashman. I'm calling from Lowell, Massachusetts. My family's been dealing with this sort of nonsense since the turn of the last century. My great-aunt Katie, who was quite the stalwart Kerry gal, used to say, no Irish need apply. Whoever wrote it well. The same is on the gates of hell. Some things never change.
Thanks so much to our listeners for those calls. And y para nuestra audiencia que habla español, que sepan que aquí en The Takeaway también lo hablamos. Si queremos comunicar con ustedes, llámenos al 877-869-8253 o tuiteanos @TheTakeaway @TanzinaVega.